Welcome back to Copper Country Today. I'm your host, Rick Gallen, and joining me in studio right now is Lieutenant General Jack Bergman of the U.S. Marine Corps, who is also running for U.S. Congress in the 1st Congressional District of Michigan. Jack, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Rick. Thanks. Nice to be with you.
So let's kind of start with who you are, where you come from. What do you call home?
Home is Waters Meet, Michigan, the beautiful intersection of U.S. 2 and U.S. 45.
Oh, so you are a Upper Peninsula guy.
I am. My dad's family came to the UP in the 1880s, to Ironwood.
All right. And so is that where you still live?
I live in Waters Meet. I built a house in Waters Meet 22 years ago.
Okay. And reading your bio, and that's kind of my first introduction that I had to you after we heard that you had announced your candidacy, a remarkable and very impressive military service career. So let's go ahead and start there, and I'll give you kind of a chance to, you know, just talk about your service.
Well, you know, in 1969, when I graduated from college, this little thing called Vietnam was going on, and I decided, being proactive, I joined the Marines a couple years in advance to go to flight school after college so I could go fly helicopters. And I got a chance to do that, spent a tour in Vietnam, spent a tour as a flight instructor afterwards back in Pensacola, and decided to seek my fame and fortune in the business world. Following that, finished an MBA degree and at night while I was flying during the day, and got out and got in the medical equipment business, but I stayed in the reserves. So fast forward 20-some years of reserve time, plus time in the medical equipment arena, plus some time as a Northwest Airlines pilot. 1998, the Marine Corps Reserve decided I should have a star. One star led to two stars, led to three stars. And, of course, over that time frame, 9/11 occurred, and the unprecedented use of the Guard and Reserve since then required me to come back on active duty from 2003 to 2009.
Now, with your business ventures and stuff, as you were going back into the service, what happened with those?
Good question, because I sacrificed at least two businesses, or two distributorships, if you will, that men and women who serve in the Guard and Reserve, people really have no idea what they go through and sacrifice when they get called up. And there have been times where people have lost their businesses because they signed up, you know, swore an oath to a constitution and left, and by the time they got back from their deployment, their business was gone.
You have also headed up a number of both departments and other ventures within the military as well.
I had the opportunity to command at all levels. The premier command for any Marine Lieutenant Colonel, active or reserve, of course, is to the command a battalion or a squadron in the fight. That's the last time you really, at that level, you really get to do that. That's what we're all about, is leading Marines. But I had the opportunity at the general officer level to have several different commands, the last of which was the largest force level command in the Marine Corps that was about 100,000 folks, 183 sites across the country, and we had responsibility for a lot of mobilizations, demobilizations, training and readiness, and it was headquartered in New Orleans, and we moved to New Orleans 2 months before Hurricane Katrina. So that was our first leadership challenge right there, was to get out, get everybody safe, get them dispersed around the country, and then we got back about 90 days later, and everybody made it back without any injury.
So the next question does sound a little odd, since you've had so much of an extensive background in both business and military. The question is, what about public service, since I believe this is the first public office you're running for?
It is. Well, you know, especially as you get to the senior officer levels in the military, we are very apolitical. We swore an oath to a constitution, not a party, not a person, but a constitution. So the military does not take sides, whether it's Republican, Democrat, Libertarian, Green, you name it. We are the United States military. The military, by design, is led or utilized. It's led by military leaders, but it's utilized by the elected and appointed civilian leaders. And a lot of people don't really know how that works, and it's important in this day and age especially, because we have so many of our members of Congress and some of our appointed leaders that have not had any military experience. Not that that's bad, it's just that it possibly limits their perspective on how you actually fully utilize America's most deadly but most precious resource. It's young men and women who have volunteered to join the United States military. You know, we don't take that obligation to those folks, those service members, and especially their families lightly.
Is that part of your motivation for running?
Well, it is, because really, no matter who gets elected president in the next cycle here, none of the candidates that are currently, you know, still in the mix have military experience. So it's important, in fact, it's imperative that Congress have some members who have extensive military background so they can evaluate the wisdom of sending troops or spending money or doing whatever it is to make, you know, our America safe through the use of the military.
Prior to this, had he ever considered running for office before?
You know, I really hadn't. I was happy to serve in a uniform. Service comes in many forms. And I was raised in a family where my dad went to World War II, came back, like so many little towns. He and my uncle and a couple other folks started the local VFW club. And when I was a little kid, or VFW post, I should say, as a little kid, I grew up serving, handing out buddy poppies, collecting with a coin can, collecting on Memorial Day to support the veterans group. So that was the beginning of my service, followed by military service. There's community service. Now I view this next step as service to our nation in a suit as opposed to a uniform.
Very interesting. Very interesting way to look at it. How's your family as far as supporting this effort?
120% behind me. If my wife was not, I wouldn't be doing this. She's all about serving. I've never known anyone that has a stronger maternal instinct than my wife. She's a nurturer, and she believes that as we look at what our grandkids' future could be like and the challenges in security and stability, let's face it, not everybody likes America. And there are people out there who would like to do us harm. And as we look at life, we look at it through the lens of a grandparent looking at our grandkids and what kind of world are we leaving them? Is it going to be safe? Is it going to be secure? Is it going to be the kind of world that we had because our parents or grandparents stood up to the bad guys in the late 1930s through the mid-40s? I think that's what we're facing today.
So if elected, and you'll be serving in the U.S. Congress, so a number of, say the military has been viewed differently in the last, say, 10 to 20 years than perhaps in the years before that, some of the way it's been utilized or at least it has been portrayed. How do you see our military and its function in the world right now?
Well, you know, you can't be everything to everybody. So we cannot be the police force for the world. The way militaries have always been successful, if you look at history, is they made coalitions, they made allies out of different, you know, countries or entities that together they did what needed to be done at the time it needed to be done. So the key is the United States military needs to be able to work with our allies around the world. We talk about joint forces. Well, that's joint forces within the United States force construct. Then you have allied coalitions that form up among different countries based upon a need because there is a threat.
Are we doing enough to keep the world safe right now?
We're the challenge of building coalitions is just that. It's a challenge because if you're not all in, then you probably could be doing a little bit more. So we as the United States have to take the lead in the vast majority of the cases. But taking the lead doesn't mean we are the ones that do all the fighting. There has to be someone to stand next to us who will stand and fight with us because in the end, it's probably their country that we're fighting in.
I want to kind of grab a few issues that are important to residents of the Upper Peninsula and throughout northern Michigan. Let's start with veterans and veterans care. You would seem to be, you know, very uniquely positioned to understand these issues. What do you see that needs to be addressed?
In its simplest form, veterans should not have to travel to get veterans care. We've now come out, the VA has come out with the Veterans Choice Card, allows them to go to local facilities to get their treatment so they don't have to travel long ways, especially this time of year. It can be a real challenge, especially if they can't drive themselves and have to get somebody else. So it just makes sense that the veteran in your community, you should be able to go to your, you know, your local physician, your local emergency room, your local hospital, have it paid for by the VA. That program is in process. I mean, it's working right now. Has it got some lumps and bumps? Yes. Like any program, get it started, get it rolling, and then smooth out the lumps and bumps so the veteran can get the care now, get the right level of care. The VA, it's been knocked a little bit over the course of time, and I would suggest to you that, like any organization, there's always room for improvement, in some cases more than, rather than others. But there's probably no need for the Veterans Administration to be in the big hospital business. There are enough big hospitals around where the veterans can go to the local big hospital, but there might be some issues where it's, let's say, mental health, prosthetics, because we have young men and women now surviving in combat because of the body armor that we wear, that when the improvised explosive devices go off, you can lose arms, limbs, traumatic brain injury. So we have a different injury set now to deal with. The good news is these youngsters are still alive. The bad news is they're going to have different kind of challenges now. Some of the advances in medical devices and behavioral health are come to the general public because they were honed as a result of the military going through this first. So the general public at large will benefit down the road. So if you look at what kind of facilities the VA should probably have, let's be the first in prosthetics. Let's be the first in mental health. We all need a little help every now and again, whether we like it or not, they like to admit it or not, we do. And sometimes the guys get together, you know, at the bar and have a beer. Sometimes folks, you know, get together at a family outing, whatever allows you to get your hand around life. The challenge with veterans today coming back from the fight is, unlike in World War II, where they might have left the front and they rode a troop ship home for 4 or 6 weeks, they had plenty of time to decompress. Nowadays, you can be in the battlefield in Afghanistan on a Monday at noon, you know, and on Wednesday night, you can be sitting watching the same battlefield at your home in Oklahoma City, whatever, with your family, and you're physically there, but where's your mind? We're working on that, but we have a ways to go to allow these folks coming off the front line to be able to get their head around exactly some of the things that went on. And people are working hard at it, but it still is a challenge.
Some other votes that you would be asked to take part in if you were elected to the Congress is, let's take a look at like immigration and specifically I've seen it referred to in news bites as the Muslim question. And I think the only person that's causing it a question is somebody running for president right now. If you were to be casting your vote on what to do with immigration or for reform or what to do with refugees coming from the Middle East, what would be your stance?
Well, number one, on immigration, we have legal immigrants. We have policies and procedures in effect for a long time to allow people to come to our country, go through the process, get their, you know, get all their cards and papers and all of that. And then we have illegal immigration. So you have apples and oranges. Okay, the apples of the legal immigration, let's enforce the policies. Let's move forward, continue to move forward to, if we need to use a military term, surge for a period of time to accommodate a larger number of people because our system has not sped up based upon the flow of people, then I would suggest maybe in the military we talk about surge operations. Let's surge it. Let's figure out a way to make our existing procedures work better for us. As far as those who are here illegally, the idea that someone would come here and stay is, if we continue to provide free, everything free with no commitment to actually take a next step, we're not leading people towards the legal immigration side of the business. So I would suggest to you we need to take a real hard look at what we continue to provide on a long-term basis for those who are not here legally. Now, when you combine the question of who we let into the country based upon their belief or whatever that happens to be, think about when we go to an airport now. We all go through security. We do that because of events that occurred a decade plus ago or even longer than that ago. We need to know who's in our country. However we do that, it's going to require more effort on the part of those agencies who screen people. So you don't cut it off completely, but you definitely take a closer look because you can tell that there are certain areas of the world that produce people who want to do us harm. We just have to call it like it is. Again, you don't eliminate it, but you certainly step up the scrutiny of the folks.
As an Upper Peninsula resident, you've got to enjoy the Great Lakes, and for much of your life, I'm sure, as we, you know, any of us from Michigan have been able to do. I bring it in this way to kind of talk about the relationship between, you know, using the resources in the Upper Peninsula while at the same time trying to maintain, you know, the pristine nature of the area that we live in. It becomes a delicate tightrope sometimes to watch, to walk. And something like with mining and with the timber industry, where do you fall as far as trying to balance those two?
Well, I think sometimes people get narrowly focused on natural resources and we have to do this to preserve them. But then they forget about the fact that if you don't utilize your natural resources, which then creates wealth, which creates jobs, which creates an economy, which creates a social side of the social resources of the communities. If you don't balance all three, you can't just say we're just going to leave. We're not going to turn the UP into a big national park. That's not an option. We need to utilize the resources we have, whether it's mining, whether it's the woods, whether it's the transportation on the water, whether it's building some type of 21st century port, so that we can, you know, be great to have a processing center for whatever it happened to be here, so the raw materials flow into here, because if the raw materials are coming in, then the processing is done here. That means jobs, again, the economy, everything becomes vibrant. But what I've seen in some cases, people just want to say, nope, we can't touch the water. Nope, we can't touch the woods. Nope, we can't touch this. Well, no, you can touch it. You need to touch it, and because that's what creates all the other things that you like.
Do you have any wolves out by your place?
We do. We do. In the summertime, probably twice a week. Of course, you know, we have an air conditioner in our house in Watersmeet, and we usually turn it on twice a year. Once in the spring to make sure it works, and once in the summer there'll be some very humid time where we have guests who need to just, you know, it's too humid for them, so we turn it on to get some of the humidity out of the air. But the point is, most of the time our windows are open, and a couple times a week you'll hear late at night, you'll hear the kill. Another deer is gone because the wolves, you know, took it. We've seen them, you know, and then where we live. I believe that, you know, wildlife has to be managed, kind of like resources. You don't let it go crazy. You manage it.
Since the federal government has the one that has stepped in and sort of taken that ability to make that decision away from the state, and when the concern of the wolves, you know, locally here, we have a much different perspective than, you know, they may have in Washington about trying to, you know, of course, we all want to protect the wolves. I'm happy that the species has rebounded. Wouldn't want to see it go away, you know, in our area or any others. But it's a common problem for anybody that lives up here, especially if they live anywhere a little ways from the main metropolises. Not that we have those much in the UP, but, you know, the main populous centers, living with the wolves and the carnage that sometimes they bring.
Well, let's put it this way. Where we live, we walk in the woods. We walk down trails. I carry a gun. Okay? Because I'm with grandkids. They have dogs. We don't have dogs. But my grandkids, you know, bring their dogs when they come up. And when you're dealing with nature, you have to understand that nature does what nature does, and it's instinct. They don't really smell whether it's human or anything else. They're not going to rationalize whether what they attack. So when you live in the middle of it, you manage it. You don't assume any unnecessary risk for yourself, or especially when I'm walking out there with my granddaughters or grandsons. People who live in a city, I believe, lack perspective when it comes to the realities of what we live with out here and what the dangers are. Just like we don't really worry about rush hour traffic mm-hmm. that people who live in cities do. But as an kind of to finish that comment, keep the federal government in the business that they should be in. Everything else should be dealt with by the state.
From your comment of having a gun there, I'm going to believe that then you would be a strong supporter of Second Amendment rights.
Well, absolutely. There's, you know, we got so many important issues on the plate that we have to deal with. We should not be wasting any time even discussing the Second Amendment. If you want to discuss what it is to be a responsible gun owner and be able to hit what you shoot at, that's a totally different discussion. Because all of that, as a Marine, we got some of the finest firearms training that exists in the world today. But we respect our weapons, and we don't call them guns. We call them weapons because that's exactly what they're for. But again, that's part of who we are, is our ability to defend ourselves, our ability to just do the right thing when the right thing needs to be done. And if that involves a weapon, then so be it.
Jack, you're coming into the race as sort of a late entry, in that there's already some pretty heavy hitters that are, you know, involved in this. Of course, with Senator Tom Casperson, Jerry Cannon, Lon Johnson on the other side, Jason Allen also on the Republican side. What's your plan, I guess, in order to stand out from that crowd?
Well, I don't think you change Washington, D.C. I've been there, lived there for 6 years, 2003 to 2009. I had offices in Washington, D.C., because at least 40% of my time was spent there dealing with everything from the Pentagon to testifying on Capitol Hill to doing the things required of a Marine Corps general. The difference in Washington, D.C. is that you have to understand how it works or doesn't work. If you go to Washington, D.C. for the first time, it takes you a bit of time to ramp up, to get a feel. I've already been there. I already put together a network 6 years ago. Well, now, it's been 6 years since I've been retired, 12 years ago, that facilitated our ability to get our message to the people who needed to hear what was going on, again, in my case, as it related to the Marine Corps Reserve. Having said already that you don't change Washington, D.C., if we expect to get the bang for our buck from the people we send there, you have to change the type of people you send to Washington, D.C. I'm not looking for another career. As I said earlier in this interview, I believe this is a transition for my service to the country from a uniform to a suit. So what I bring to the table that the others do not is the highest level leadership for the longest period of time that actually resided in D.C., and I'm a full-up round, you know, even before I put my hand on the Bible and swear in as a United States Congressman on November 9th of 2016, assuming I'm elected, I'll already be setting up the network so that when I swear in January, we're ready to go to support and represent the voters of the 1st District.
Jack, thanks so much for coming in, and good luck on the rest of your campaign.
Thank you.
Copper Country Today, we'll be right back.